This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, July 19, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. President Bush will announce his nominee to replace Sandra Day O'Connor. We'll hear the latest from Washington. We'll take a look at the debate over the status of women under the new Iraqi government. And the month-long standoff at a Oaxacan newspaper ends in a bloody takeover of the newspaper's offices. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Leanne Caldwell with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Great Britain has successfully fast-tracked tough anti-terror legislation through the government. The movement, led by Home Secretary Charles Clarke, is expected to become law by the end of the year. Helen Kelly reports from London.
The bill will introduce an offence of inciting terrorism by default, which will outlaw preachers who, for example, glorify suicide bombers. The bill will also outlaw activities such as accessing terrorist websites and acquiring bomb-making instructions. A third new law would ban terrorist training and make it an offence to undergo training in Britain or abroad. The government seeks to prevent terror groups evading the law by simply changing their name. The Home Secretary wants the power to rule they are the same prescribed organisation. Other measures include extending anti-terror stop and search powers to inland waterways and closing a loophole so that it is an offence to plan an explosion abroad. This is Helen Kelly reporting from London for Free Speech Radio News.
The Guardian newspaper reported that more than 2,000 people, 200 of them foreign-born scientists, have been blocked from doing postgraduate or postdoctoral work in chemistry, biotechnology, and microbiology in Great Britain. The Guardian received the information under a Freedom of Information Act, in which security forces said the measure was a precaution against terrorism after the attacks of September 11, 2001. Tokyo's High Court refused to compensate nearly 200 Chinese victims of biological warfare experiments during World War II. The decision upheld a lower court decision that for the first time acknowledged that Japan conducted biological warfare. The court today said that reparations were settled in an agreement between the two countries in 1972. Guatemala won two victories against impunity. One is the arrest warrant issued for former President Alfonso Portillo for embezzling public funds. And the second is the state's public acceptance of responsibility for a 1982 massacre. Joe Rapoglia reports from Guatemala.
A Guatemalan court issued an arrest warrant yesterday for former President Alfonso Portillo for embezzlement of public funds. Portillo governed the country from 2000 to 2004. He's accused of authorizing multi-million-dollar transfers that ended up in private business accounts. The arrest warrant issued opens the door for extraditing the former president from Mexico, where he currently resides. This is the first time a national court has directly implicated Portillo. It is also the first time a Guatemalan court has issued an arrest warrant for a former president. In another acknowledgement of faults, the Guatemalan government publicly recognized the army's responsibility for the 1982 massacre in the village of Plan de Sanchez. 263 citizens were killed in the massacre, and dozens of women were raped. Jill Replogle, FSRN, Guatemala.
In Indian-administered Kashmir, leaders from the moderate separatist faction held a meeting with the leaders of the migrant Hindus. This is the first time that the leaders of the two communities are speaking with each other since violence broke out in Kashmir 16 years ago. Shatnawaz Khan has more from Kashmir.
It was both a significant and symbolic meeting. For the first time after the Kashmiri Hindus, called the Kashmiri Pandits, fled their homeland in the early 90s, they met with moderate separatist leaders of Kashmir. The leaders hugged and talked about the possible return of Pandits. An anti-India insurgency broke out in the Muslim-dominated Indian-administered Kashmir in 1989. Facing a hostile atmosphere, the Hindus, a minority in Kashmir, fled to safer places. Many of them are still living in the migrant camps in Jammu and Delhi. After the meeting today, the two said in a joint statement that both of them will work towards a favorable environment leading to the return of Kashmiri Pandits to their homeland. However, some prominent Pandit organizations like Panan Kashmir opposed the meeting, blaming the separatists for their migration. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan from Srinagar, Kashmir.
The Pentagon plans to develop Eastern European bases as staging areas for fighting in the Middle East. Selina Masuda reports from Washington, D.C.
Today, on the Romanian port of Constanta, located on the Black Sea, 1,500 U.S. troops are taking part in urban warfare exercises with 400 Romanian soldiers. In the neighboring country of Bulgaria, their troops are conducting their own military exercises with hundreds of U.S. soldiers. Romania and Bulgaria are negotiating with the Pentagon over building permanent U.S. bases in their countries. These bases will be used as the deployment grounds for U.S. troops before they go off to the Middle East, Africa, and Central Asia. The Pentagon is planning on moving thousands of their troops and their families out of their German bases. Selina Masuta, FSRN in Washington, D.C.
The United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization has warned that 2.5 million people in the impoverished West African state of Niger face starvation as the country's food crisis worsens. Sam Alakoya reports from Lagos.
The food crisis follows drought and a plague of locusts, which destroyed Niger's food reserve. 3,000 villages are affected by the food crisis. About a third of those facing starvation are children. Some of them have already died. The aid agency World Vision warns that 10% of the children in the worst affected areas could die. Many villages are empty as thousands of hungry people have left their homes in search of food in neighboring countries such as Nigeria and Benin Republic. Niger is one of the poorest countries in the world. Even though the government is supplying food at reduced cost, most people in the country cannot afford to buy such food. Aid agencies say the international community has not done enough to assist the country. They predict the situation will worsen in the coming months if nothing urgent is done. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
And I'm Leanne Caldwell at WPFW in Washington, D.C.
President Bush will announce a Supreme Court justice nominee tonight to replace Sandra Day O'Connor. At 9 p.m. Eastern and 6 p.m. Pacific, the president's announcement will be broadcast nationally on most major television networks. Capitol Hill correspondent Mitch Jezerich has this preview on who may be named later on tonight.
White House spokesperson Scott McClellan announced today that President Bush would make his nomination of a new Supreme Court Justice Associate tonight.
The president has made it clear that he intends to nominate a fair-minded individual who represents the mainstream. He will appoint someone to the position of high intellect and great legal ability, a person of integrity who will faithfully interpret our Constitution and our laws.
In these last few hours for the nominee is known, lawmakers and advocacy groups from both the left and right are readying themselves for a potential battle. Elliot Mintzberg is with the People for the American Way.
We and many others, Democrats and Republicans, have urged the president to choose someone in the mold of Sandra Day O'Connor. The names that have been most recently bandied about seem decidedly to the right of her on a number of issues.
Replacing Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman to serve on the Supreme Court, President Bush will have the added pressure of possibly choosing another woman. Two women being talked about on Capitol Hill are Edith Clement and Edith Jones, both judges in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in Louisiana. Again, Elliot Mintzberg.
Clement has only been on that court for about 3.5 years, but even in that short period of time, she's overturned jury verdicts in favor of individuals against corporations. She's voted to try to rule unconstitutional important federal laws like the Endangered Species Act and other troubling decisions. Jones has done many of those things and more. Jones, who again has a longer record, has a more explicit position, severely questioning Roe versus Wade, arguing against basic principles of church-state separation, has a very bad record on sexual harassment cases, among others.
However, Democratic Senator Joe Lieberman, who was part of the so-called Gang of 14 who saved the judicial filibuster but passed through some of Bush's most controversial district court nominees, called for calmness.
There's too much partisanship, too much polarization in our politics.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
In Baghdad today, guerrillas assassinated two Sunni members of the committee appointed to rewrite Iraq's constitution. Various aspects of the document have sparked debate amongst Iraqis, and one of the most contentious is the status of women under the new government. David Enders files this report.
Not far from where Mijbel Issa, one of the 15 Sunna Arabs appointed to the Constitution Committee about a week ago, was gunned down, women from across the country demonstrated in favor of drafting a constitution with an article specifically ensuring equality for women. The committee to draft the constitution now consists of 9 women and 60 men. 4 of the women on the council represent conservative Islamic political parties, which are pushing for Sharia law to govern matters of personal status. The demonstration was one of the few places in Iraq that Nagam Khadim, a women's rights activist from the conservative Shiite holy city of Najaf, 2 hours south of Baghdad, might find herself in the minority while wearing a hijab. Nagam says the recent elections, in which electoral law stipulated that a quarter of the candidates be women, were marred by the fact that many of the candidates had remained anonymous because of security concerns, and women had, as a result, elected women who did not represent them.
We are educating everyone in Najaf about the constitution and the vote to ratify the constitution. We are under the stress of the religious extremists and tribal influences. We would like to get away from those and to have our human rights and to be treated like women everywhere else in the world. We are not against Sharia, we are with it. But it would not be the only basis for writing the constitutions. The liberals should be allowed to go ahead with their own ethics.
Since the invasion of Iraq more than 2 years ago, many women complain that the forced secularism of Saddam Hussein's government has given way to an atmosphere in which many cover their heads or modify their behavior out of fear of retribution from conservative militias. Inside the Green Zone, the heavily fortified area that houses the U.S. Embassy and Iraqi government offices, women discuss the framing of the Constitution. This is not the first fight over women's rights since the invasion. In the spring of 2004, the U.S. appointed Iraqi Governing Council was set to pass an edict enshrining Sharia as the basis for personal status law before pressure from Iraqi women forced then-U.S. Proconsul Paul Bremer to veto it. Raja Al-Hoza is one of the women on the Constitution Committee. Like the others, she is concerned that women are underrepresented on the body, though that issue has received far less attention than that of Sunna representation.
The Sunnis, they never brought women with them. That was the big concern. I thought they will bring women with them, you know, so that we will have a bigger number of women. But all 15 are men.
Al-Huzai says one issue is a provision stipulating that the Iraqi government be made up of 25% women for the next 8 years, or 2 terms, under the system envisioned in the current draft. Al-Huzai says she was the only woman who opposed limiting the measure.
And I told them, now in the National Assembly we are 31%, so why we go backward? This is one thing. And the other thing, why you stop the quota after 2 terms? They said, well, because you call for equality, and then we'll be equal. So I said, it's not fair, okay? The Iraqis they are not very, very keen to elect or to vote for women, okay? But without the quota, I don't think we will win. We'll never see any woman sitting with you. And they made jokes after I spoke.
It was unclear whether today's assassination would slow the delivery of the Constitution, which members say will be on time. The committee has until August 1st to request a 6-month extension. If it does not request the extension, the draft must be presented by August 15th. If that happens, the draft will go to a national referendum in October. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
After 1 month of being sequestered in their building, press workers for Oaxaca, Mexico's best-selling newspaper, Noticias, were attacked last night. More than 100 people posing as strikers, police officers dressed in civilian clothing, and members of a political party that is led by a local parliamentary deputy of the ruling party of Oaxaca broke into the building and violently evacuated the 31 workers. The Noticias building was attacked as fireworks lit the night sky, celebrating a regional holiday in Oaxaca. At that time, the violent mob broke into the building, attacked the 31 workers, and destroyed the newspaper's office equipment with wooden bats and metal batons. The entire street where the Noticias building is located was also surrounded by trucks and buses. In Oaxaca, Shannon Young brings us the latest.
The main offices of Oaxaca's largest daily newspaper had been inaccessible since June 17th, when a crowd claiming to be striking workers set up camp in front of the Noticias building, leading to a standoff with 31 of the newspaper's employees blockaded inside of their workplace. But the month-long stalemate erupted into violence at approximately 8:15 last night. Noticias assistant editor Genaro Altamirano gives his account of the assault.
Fue un asalto bien premeditado, bien planeado, protegido por las policías. Había patrullas protegiendo. Llegó un operativo.
It was very premeditated, very much planned, protected by police patrols, including an operation by state police. There was also police in plain clothes, so they took the newspaper building by force from different directions. They forced open and damaged two of the doors. They also came in via the roof and others using ladders via the terrace. So they caused damages. They had no intention of dialoguing nor of simply telling us to leave. They removed us using heavy sticks. They threatened us with death. They fired off shots from the roof with a firearm, and really, they threatened to even kill us.
Noticias managing editor Ismael San Martin describes what he witnessed when the crowd outside forced their way into the building.
Uno de los compañeros dice, ya vienen, ya vienen.
One of our colleagues said to us, here they come, and between this and their arrival, there were about 3 minutes. We heard a bang from a big door that we had in the auditorium and how they poured in. They broke the windows, which made a tremendous noise because they were very thick windows. They came in, and we held ourselves up in a newsroom that we have there that's about 35 meters by 12 meters wide.
35 metros por unos 12 de ancho, aproximadamente la redacción, nos atrincheramos. ¿No?
San Martin says that a group of assailants forcibly removed them from the newsroom into the reception area, while others tore the offices apart.
Nos salimos todos para esto.
So we were all leaving. At this moment, with bat and iron rods, they were rapidly destroying the computers like it was some sort of demolition contest. There were around 34, 35 computers destroyed there, as well as glass dividers, desks, everything. Everything was ransacked.
Many allege that the local PRI party has a hand in the conflict. The PRI dominated Mexico for over 7 decades and continues to hold power in Oaxaca. Both the current governor and his predecessor were on unfriendly terms with the Noticias newspaper. However, after last night's assault at the newspaper's offices, the governor, Ulises Ruiz Ortiz, denied any involvement. Noticias reporter Octavio Vélez was inside of the building at the time of the assault.
El gobernador Ulises Ruiz Ortiz.
The governor Ulises Ruiz Ortiz has said that he has no hand in this matter. I would just like to ask him then, why, since the beginning of the blockade at the Noticias building on June 17th, have police in plain clothes been participating? Why has the Arbitration and Reconciliation Court been acting like a mafia, negating a response to the petition presented by the company and the workers? Why is it that just now police in plain clothes and police in uniforms have participated in the assault at the newspaper building?
En el asalto final al periódico.
Those inside of the building during the assault say that a number of their personal belongings were confiscated, including wallets, cell phones, identification, and even the keys to their homes. For FSRN, this is Shannon Young with Vladimir Flores in Oaxaca City.
The governments of Iraq and Iran signed a landmark oil pact today, capping off Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari's historic trip to Tehran. Under the terms of the agreement, Iraq will begin sending 150,000 barrels of crude oil a day to refineries in Iran. Iran also extended a $1 billion line of credit to Iraq and agreed to send the occupied country 200,000 tons of grain. The warming of relations between the two countries is generating a muted response in Washington, where the Bush administration is facing fresh allegations that it tried to fix Iraq's elections in January. Aaron Glantz reports.
Iraq's new Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari knows the mullahs of Iran well. During the 1980s, when the United States supported Saddam's regime, Jafari and other Shiite religious dissidents took shelter in the Islamic Republic, where they received help from the Iranian government in their quest to overthrow Saddam.
The current diplomacy can easily be understood in the context of the relationship between Iran and the Shiite opposition during the reign of Saddam Hussein.
Dr. Mansour Farhang was Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the UN. He defected when fundamentalists took control of the revolt.
For 20-some years, when Saddam's regime decimated the Shiites, massacred them, Iran was the only country in the region that assisted. And many of the today's Iraq's leaders spent years and years in Iran. So today, one part of the axis of evil has become the close ally of a government which is supposed to symbolize new American policies.
Warming relations have brought a muted response from Washington, which directly controlled Iraq's government for almost 2 years before allowing Iraq to hold elections this January. Many observers had speculated Bush delayed the elections because he was afraid Shiites friendly to Iran would triumph at the polls. Those speculations were buoyed by a report this week in the New Yorker magazine. In the magazine, investigative journalist Seymour Hersh documents how the Bush administration tried to fix the results, helping the campaign of former CIA agent Iyad Alawi. Hersh spoke this morning on Pacifica's Democracy Now! Program.
There was some direct intimidation by Iraqi police of people at the polls, telling them how to vote. There was money. There were intelligence, former CIA people who bragged after the election of stuffing ballots.
In the end, however, the Shiite slate led by Ibrahim al-Jafari won anyway, seizing close to 50% of all seats in the National Assembly. But even after the victory, the Shiite slate must answer to the U.S. government. Each of Ibrahim al-Jafari's ministers has an American advisor who needs to sign off on all its moves. Iranian-American activist Pervez Shokat believes the situation on the ground in Iraq has gotten so bad that the Bush administration is willing to get help from anywhere. And he says the Iranian regime is happy to reciprocate.
Can on one hand say we're going to help you out if you leave us alone. And on the other hand, of course, they have a lot of influence there.
Meantime, Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei told reporters that, quote, U.S. soldiers are doing much to harm Iraq and the peoples of the region. He made that comment alongside a smiling Iraqi premier. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
Iraqi donor countries began a two-day meeting in Jordan on Monday aimed at injecting new momentum into reconstruction of the war-torn country. Olaf Arawati has more.
Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari attended the meeting. Delegates from 60 countries and organizations, including the UN and the World Bank, are also taking part. The meeting follows an international conference on Iraq last month. Some observers say Iraq is at a critical juncture, with the escalating violence and lack of security raising questions over whether donors will want to take the risk of investing in Iraq. Iraq's planning minister said his country should be in charge of reconstruction efforts instead of foreign donors, and he laid out a strategy aimed at improving life for Iraqis frustrated by security and political challenges.
We need Iraqi leadership. We need Iraqi ownership of the reconstruction program and a partnership with the international community. Priority must be given to the projects which yield the most benefit to the greatest number of Iraqis in the shortest possible time.
Opening the conference, Jordan's Prime Minister Adnan Badran said that terrorism, extremism, and violence are obstacles to the reconstruction process and to building a unified and democratic Iraq that has a place on the international scene and is able to achieve prosperity for its people.
contributing to the reconstruction process in Iraq and achieving security and stability in Iraq for its people, the region, and the world is a priority for Jordan.
The special advisors to Iraq's Ministry for Industry and Minerals, Manhouth Jassim, urged donors ahead of the gathering to follow the example of Japan, which has already invested $260 million in the country. Creating jobs for the Iraqi people was essential to avert a catastrophe. Some 2 years ago, donor countries pledged $33 billion in aid to Iraq. Of this amount, just $1 billion has been handed over so far.
Jordanian analyst Hassan Shobaki said the international community is showing neglect to the Iraqi situation at a time when all world countries should cooperate to solve the Iraqi dilemma.
With all those participants, it's a pity that no one is delivering. World countries just come to these conferences to get media attention by pledging support and not delivering any. But the question is, to whom do countries give support if the Iraqi government is facing chaos and bomb attacks on a daily basis? The situation is very bizarre.
This is Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech Radio News from the shores of the Dead Sea, Jordan.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan and the U.S. government are expressing support for the peace deal reached between Indonesia and the Free Aceh Movement, or GAM, following a 30-year armed conflict that claimed nearly 15,000 lives. While the European Union will soon start monitoring the peace process, local NGOs have already set up monitoring teams. In Jakarta, FSRN's Maggie Margiono reports on the political process in Jakarta and Aceh days after the GAM and Indonesia reached common ground in Helsinki.
Indonesian Armed Forces Commander General Endriartono Sutarto has agreed to gradually decrease the number of army personnel deployed in Aceh. In addition, the Free Aceh Movement, or GAM, has stated that it will disarm guerrilla army members and collect their guns. Bustami is an Aceh man who works with the Commission for the Victims of Violations and Involuntary Disappearances.
The situation in the city of Banda Aceh is peaceful. However, in eastern Aceh and southern Aceh, military operations continue, just like when martial law was practiced. For example, Indonesian army members still hunt GAM members. Parents whose sons join GAM have to register their identities with local military posts.
Bustami also says that it is important to realize that the security arrangement to save the Helsinki peace agreement was made by diplomats.
The actual field situation in Aceh has never been taken into account. For example, the offer to decrease the number of Indonesian troops deployed to Aceh must also be accompanied by policy to change the function of local military to be functions of military in a normal situation, not the operations of military in a wartime situation.
Despite the agreement to declare peace in Aceh on August 15th, debates over GAM's demand to build local political parties continues. Indonesian parliament members were split over the issue of local political parties. 10 political parties argue that GAM members should be candidates of local elections without establishing local political parties. But GAM rejects the proposal of those 10 parties. Sofyan Daoued, spokesperson for GAM's armed forces, explains.
I am confused about their offer. We, GAM, do not surrender. We do not accept autonomy, and we made a deal on self-government. Therefore, I am confused when they ask us to join their political parties that we never supported. In addition, the offer to join their parties is not part of the peace talks.
Indonesian Vice President Yusuf Kalla said that Indonesia needs to change electoral laws if it wants to accommodate GAM's demands to build local political parties. I'm Eric Klein, reading for Maggie Margiono from Jakarta for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Zimba Russo. Our headlines editor is Leanne Caldwell. Mitch Jezerich is our Washington editor. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, McMillan, and Eric Klein. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.